Last week, we heard from Peter Osborne, who wants to know what happens to our PhDs after graduation. Do most graduates find employment in their field? Okay, so what percentage? Is work in an Asian country a viable option? Peter Osborne.
In Australia, somewhat surprisingly, this data appears not to be collated at the national level at present. So let's look back to Japan. The Japanese Ministry of Education, Culture, Sport, Science and Technology keeps the most bewildering array of statistics for all things educational. In Japan, in 2012, 67% of PhDs and 74% of master's graduates entered some form of employment within the first year of graduation. These are the highest levels of employment on record. No figures are kept for the second year after graduation, but one would assume that your chances of finding employment diminish with each passing year of unemployment. These Japanese data document that 1 in 3 PhDs and 1 in 4 masters graduate to unemployment. Given Japan's comprehensive manufacturing economy, these employment figures are probably similar to or better than what would be found in Australia, and reinforces the copious anecdotal evidence from Japan to Geelong and from Taiwan to Tasmania that jobs for PhD graduates are hard to find. If there are few jobs in Oz, what's the keen young PhD graduate to attempt? Being an unemployed graduate, you become a mute voice for revision at universities because you are neither an employee nor a student. If you want to continue in science and not feel intellectually shortchanged, depressed, and repay your debt, you need to find employment, preferably scientific employment. One possibility is to try for postdoctoral positions overseas. Since Australia is refocusing itself to be in touch with Asia and the perceived economic markets, a recent PhD graduate could attempt doing postdoctoral studies or finding employment and integration into Asian universities. Japan, Taiwan, China, and Korea all have postdoctoral positions available for suitably qualified foreign candidates who can manage to contact a national researcher or professor employed at a suitably resourced academic or research institute. Historically, PhD graduates were the first global citizens, frequently an educated gentry. They were expected to physically travel overseas to broaden their technical and intellectual prowess with a few years' employment and polish at famed European or American institutes. Productive Antipodeans that managed to escape the strong intellectual gravitational attraction of these overseas giants and who returned to an Australian-centric intellectual orbit could realistically expect a tenured position at an Australian university or research school. Today, this educational trajectory is vaporously elusive at best, as tangible as a jet trail. The point of this brief historical digression is to lead this conversation towards highlighting the obvious but overlooked hiccups of postdocing overseas. Numerically, there are very few scientists in the world. As a percentage, some say about 1% of the population of the first world. Of this 1%, about 10 or 20% are probably postdocing overseas at any one time. On the overall scale of things, this is really not many people actually living a truly internationalised global lifestyle. The vast majority of Australians might eat globally and shop globally, but they don't live globally. Globalisation is the spin word of the present. Globalisation is primarily about the transnational movement of goods and capital. It has very little to do with fostering the easy movement of people to work physically transnationally. The introduction of passports after the First World War restricted the free movement of people, and migration remains a hugely contentious issue, partly because it blurs the political boundaries of national identity and the human rights governments cede to residents. Government departments in all countries are organised to process large numbers, often tens of millions, of their own nationals living standardised, largely predictable lives. By and large, people's circumstances can be bureaucratically circumscribed by the tick in the box. As an international postdoc, you frequently won't fit in the boxes of your host country. And depending upon intergovernmental relationships, you may even fall outside the less than encompassing post hoc boxes. You become tickless, so to speak. No longer a functioning jack in the box. Just plain old functionless jack without a box. Let's get back to the specifics of postdocing in Asia. As someone who's done postdoctoral research in Japan, China, and Taiwan, as well as Sweden and the US, I can attest that this research path can be both scientifically fruitful and a culturally enlightening experience. The important distinction to make between postdoctoral positions in Europe and America, as compared with Asia, is the understanding of the concept of inclusion. In Europe and America, although it's getting more difficult, it is possible to become included in the university faculty with a tenured or tenure-track position if you are intellectually productive and are perceived to add value to your new department. For all its flaws, the strength of the American intellectual system is very much dependent upon its readiness to absorb the best minds from all over the world. In contrast, much of Asia, despite having adopted the American academic ranking system and, in some instances, constitutional elements, actively restrict the inclusion of non-nationals in their academic institutions. Historically, Japan, China, and Korea all have had periods of self-enforced cultural isolation. In Asian societies today, there is almost no conceptual equivalent of the phenotypically varied Australian. Phenotype is absolute, and there are only two mutually exclusive categories, a national and a foreigner, with no linguistic distinction for foreign-born nationals residing permanently in their Asian community, irrespective of how skillful you might eventually use the national language. As a consequence of real or perceived historical transgressions, most Asian countries are intensely nationalistic, and the concept of inclusion of other cultures into the national cultural image is either not practiced or carefully orchestrated to only include non-nationals to do menial, non-managerial tasks. Indonesian, Vietnamese, and Philippine nationals are employed extensively throughout Taiwan and Korea as domestic servants, aged and palliative carers, and labourers. In Japan, Brazilians and Peruvians of Japanese ancestry are employed in similar positions. Paradoxically, it's their very cultural distinctiveness that makes Asian nations so fascinating to many people from non-Asian heritage. But it is the active preservation of their cultural identity that prevents internationalization of Asian scientific communities via blocking the inclusion of young and senior non-Asian scientists from their academic institutions. Generalizations can invariably be shown to be inaccurate by specifics. But nevertheless, some generalizations can be informative. The international ranking of universities by the Times Higher Education is based upon 13 categories of assessment, one of which, International Outlook, estimates the number of foreign staff and students attending an institution. A high percentage of foreign staff is perceived by the Times rankers to be a relevant index of openness to new ideas. Better ranking universities have a higher percentage of international staff and students. Now, irrespective of whether this relationship is true, the Times results show that even high ranking Asian universities have very low numbers of foreign staff. In Japan, Taiwan, China, and Korea, the vast bulk of these foreign staff are yearly contracted English language instructors, with many universities having no or have never had any foreign scientific staff at any level. Into each of these rather phenotypically homogeneous national pots, we have to stir in the recent influence of ageing societies and peak population. Unlike Australia, Japan and Taiwan have reached peak population, and South Korea and China are following close behind. At established educational institutes in these countries, the onset of a yearly decrease in the number of students available to enrol is a paradigm-changing event that mercenarily boils down to a truly job-threatening prospect for all those employed in the educational industry. Unfortunately, even in the learned bureaucracies that run ivory towers, the dwindling of a fundamental resource almost universally promotes knee-jerk implementation of cost-cutting, enhanced attempts at competition-based ranking of academic and pedagogical performance, and a rise of protectionist employment policies. As we speak, entire universities are being sieved out of existence after having lost a Darwinian advertising battle for the enrolment of the paying student. Eventually, administrations will exhaust the reforms implemented by the usual suspect of survival of the fittest. Perhaps after it's been recognised that too big a component of the battle was actually based upon the flashy, rather less than utilitarian principles of sexual selection, they will get around to implementing pertinent reforms. And maybe these paradigm-testing conditions will spur the rise of an educational phoenix better suited to the needs of future students.
Peter Osborne in Taiwan. He returns next month with his conclusions. Next week, the final of Roots to Riches, our series from the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew, presented by Kathy Willis, their head of scientific research. Technical production this week by Simon Branthwaite and Luke Purse. I'm David Fisher. The Science Show on RN. Thanks for listening.